to be a defense, to be an apology right off the bat, right out of the chute. That's what I mean by that. So number two is referring to the AC, the Augsburg Confession. Then we'll talk about the drafting of the confession, the public reading of the confession. Luther had a mild criticism about the confession. Generally, Luther considered Melanchthon to be an outstanding theologian, but viewed him as walking softly and being tactful in comparison to himself. Luther, of course, was much bolder and had a way of offending people for some reason.
Calling them asses might have something to do
this
with it.
This is true. That might have a little bit to do with it. Yeah, Luther didn't hold back. He did not hold back. And then we had an important question come up that I did not address, well, substantially anyway, was when Barron brought up, what about, you know, these various, you know, unaltered, altered, what is all that? So we're going to talk about the alterations that Melanchthon was responsible for and why that talk even exists of the altered and unaltered AC. We'll mention the Roman Confutation, which is the Roman Catholic response to the Augsburg Confession. We're going to talk about the emperor's basic reaction of mildness. He wants everyone to get along. And so he's encouraging this unity and this agreeing and somewhat, you know, agreeing to disagree to some extent, just so we can bring peace to the empire type thing. And then, of course, we're a little bit on the apology of 1531, and now I mean the AP, the apology. And so at that point, Wesley can help us out a little bit. And then after we do that, we'll get into some of the doctrine itself, hopefully more advanced level discussions from any undergraduate course you've had. And we'll have Katrina help us out with Article 1, Daniel help us out with Article 2, Timothy help us out with Article 18. Sorry, Timothy.
No, it's my fault. I think you told me that, and I just, for whatever reason, forgot to write down one.
No,
more.
No problem. And we absolutely must finish this number one of 15 today, and we'll just keep it going here. Okay, so I mentioned the diet proclaimed by the emperor, the gathering that led to the reading of the Augsburg Confession, called by the emperor, Charles V. I read this to you yesterday. It's very eloquent in expressing his desire, again, for peace. You know, he wants to bring the sides together that represent the division. Let's find a way to come back together again. He wants healing for his empire. This is the political motivation, of course. I mentioned another historical figure, John the Steadfast of Saxony, the elector, who was really indispensable in providing for and protecting the Lutherans as they brought the Augsburg Confession before the emperor. Without his representation and protection, we wouldn't have had a chance to stand politically within the empire.
Pardon me, Professor Eskenazi, could you, it's kind of small on the screen. Is there a way you could
You know what? Normally what I do is this.
Comments.
Normally I get out of that mode and get back into this mode. Thanks for mentioning that.
Thank you.
Sorry about that.
Oh, that's all right.
Okay. So the other historical figure, I was mentioning the elector, and he is providing for and he is protecting politically and militarily Luther and the other reformers. Thank God for faithful laymen who are as soldiers in the church to advance the effort of the gospel. Now, the results presented at Torgau on March 27th. On April 23rd, the elector leaves for Augsburg. Luther was still under ban. Remember, he's essentially under ban for, you know, his writings, and he's in trouble. He's considered an outlaw, essentially. So he cannot be present at Augsburg. He's not invited. He's not welcome. So Luther remains behind. However, remember I made the point that even though Melanchthon penned the Augsburg Confession, the theology is Luther's. And I mentioned a bunch of written works like the catechisms. However, in addition to those works, Melanchthon was in correspondence with Luther. Luther was influencing him along the way through correspondence. He stays close contact with Melanchthon. He writes 70 letters to Augsburg, this is Luther, 20 of which go to Melanchthon. So Melanchthon is very much relying on Luther's leadership during this time, even though Luther is not physically present. So Luther's hand is everywhere seen in representing the Reformation. My little deliberate pauses for any questions, and give you time to finish your notes before I proceed. And we've finally gotten to the brand new material for today. So, originally, regarding the Augsburg Confession, again, don't be confused. I'm not referring to the 1531 document. I'm referring to the 1530 document, the Augsburg Confession. The original plan was to present it as a defense. So here, as you know, I'm sure you all know, but let me not. We talked about an apology, an apologia. This is a defense. A defense is a rational defense. We have this rational defense, and of course this is the way the very faith is to be presented. Always be prepared to give an answer that is a rational defense for the hope that is within you. And don't forget this part, but do it with gentleness and respect. Sometimes we forget that part. It's in 1 Peter 3:15. 1 Peter 3:15. There might be a time and a place where you have to call someone an ass, but I think for the most part, we avoid that, you know. With gentleness and respect. Too often we get Christians engaging in witnessing and apologetics, and it's kind of like one-upmanship. We just want to win the intellectual battle and say, we got you. Look at me. You know, and when people see that kind of attitude from Christians, it's just a turnoff.
You know, I found that a pointed question merits 100, well thought out arguments.
Sure.
Something that you could just leave somebody with, they can kind of mull it over themselves.
It's fantastic. I mentioned Mark Jesus to you guys yesterday, and he couldn't agree with you more that we find all kinds of divergent points to start arguing. Let's start arguing about six-day creationism. And Mark's like, he keeps bringing it back to the fundamentals. He's talking about the fact, for example, we're going to die. We are going to die.
No argument about that.
Yeah. What are you going to do? What are you going to do about it? You know, let's get to the most crucial questions. And so he does it all the time. And it helps bring that discussion back to the Lord. Yes, please.
Reminds me a lot, too, of our Lord's methodology. Which one went home righteous? You know, who loved more? You know, he does a little story and then asks a pointed question.
I'll let you answer the question.
Yeah.
Amen to that. Amen to that. So the original view, and you can tell by, when you consider some of the written works that I listed for you leading up to the AC, there was already a lot of polemics, argumentation going on, right? As when Luther was arguing against Zwingli on the Supper. So, and of course, they had plenty of reason to be concerned about the Roman Catholic position. So, originally, the vision is an apology defense. So, the original intention of Lutheran theologian was to treat of the abuses and immediately related doctrines, especially of faith and good works. Because this one was just extremely self-evident. problem of synergism, the problem of semi-Pelagianism, of basically starting out with God's grace, but then having to finish and complete the job by what you do. And of course, the Roman system could use and did use the language of the Lutherans. The Roman system permitted, for example, speaking about grace, for example, you know, they had Bibles and they read the word grace all over the Bible. But from the Roman perspective, the RC perspective, grace was understood in an infused sense. And so grace, pardon my artwork, and you'll see why I'm a pastor and not an artist. grace was, you know, we don't have to laugh though. Grace is substantive, like a hypodermic needle. So God fills you with grace. And, you know, this whole treasury of grace idea, the Roman Catholic Church idea, you're infused with grace. And now, having been infused with grace, you are enabled to do good works. And by doing the good works, now you can be fully righteous. Okay? So this infused idea is kind of like a medical. It's kind of like a medical system of grace. In the Lutheran version, we speak of grace too. But it is imputed. And imputation is not a medical system, it is a legal perspective. It is something that is declared. Not because of something inside of you that qualifies you to be righteous, but something that God declares of you even while you are still a sinner. So this imputation or imputed idea of Lutheranism, when we talk grace, we're really talking about something else. So they had plenty, you know, they had the Zwinglians in regards to real presence. They had the Catholics in regards to good works confusion. And so it's understandable that as a first step in getting to the Diet at Augsburg, we're ready for a defense here. The elector's view was that commandments of men had been preached instead of faith in Christ. Not Luther, but Luther's opponents had begun to strive. The elector was a pretty good theologian in his own right, and he knew how to spot a problem. And he knew theologically that there was a problem. He was a man of faith, which is why he loved Luther so much. He knew what Luther was about. So, in drafting the confession, what was penned by Philip Melanchthon was forwarded to Luther by the elector. So Luther, we want you to check it out, do a proofreading for us, okay? Luther returned it as early as May 15th, having written, quote, "I have read Master Philip's Apology," referring to the AC. "I am well pleased with it, and know nothing to improve or to change in it. Neither would this be proper, since I cannot step so gently and softly." "Christ our Lord, grant that it may produce much and great fruit, which indeed we hope and pray for." And so Luther commended Melanchthon. Again, viewing him as an outstanding theologian, but also someone who could approach and speak in such a way as to work with the adversary productively. Luther is said to have added Article 10 concerning the Lord's Supper, the words, quote, "and they condemn those who teach otherwise." So Luther had a way of seeing what was actually happening, and he would, you know, call it like it is.
He was a little quicker to condemn than Melanchthon.
Exactly. When you see that word, you go, yeah, that's Luther. That's Luther being Luther. So when it's returned and they bring it forward, we are now ready for the public reading of the Augsburg Confession. At the last deliberation on June 23rd, the confession was signed. And on June 25th, at 3 p.m., the ever-memorable meeting of the Diet took place, at which the Augustana was read by Chancellor Bayer in German, and both the German and Latin manuscripts were handed over. That's the day of the reading of the Augsburg Confession. June 25th at 3 p.m., 1530. Incredible day of history. After it's all said and done, Luther had a mild criticism. On June 29th, Luther wrote to Melanchthon, "I received your apology, your Augsburg Confession, and cannot understand what you may mean when you ask what and how much should be yielded to the papists. As far as I am concerned, too much has already been yielded in this Augsburg Confession, and if they reject it, I see nothing that might be yielded beyond what has been done, unless I see the proofs they proffer and clearer Bible passages than I have hitherto seen. As I have always written, I am prepared to yield everything to them if we are but given the liberty to teach the gospel. I cannot yield anything that militates against the gospel." So Luther was prepared. And we see this progression in terms of Melanchthon's leadership. The first stage, historically, in meeting the differences is marked by a conciliatory tone. We want to try to find a way to bring some unity. Let's clarify. Let's be clear about where we agree, and let's be very clear about where we disagree, but let us also demonstrate that where we disagree really has backing from the ancient church. So historically speaking, stage one, as it turns out with Melanchthon's careful approach, turns out to be less polemic and more conciliatory in tone. However, as we go on to 1531 into the apology itself, we shift from a conciliatory tone where it becomes polemical. And eventually it goes from being polemical to being condemning. So when you start to talk about power and primacy of the Pope and how we identify the papacy, at this point, there is a condemnation taking place in the sense that there is a public recognition of the denial of the gospel of Christ. So this condemning, we're not saying people are going to hell, but we're saying that the gospel is clearly being rejected, and we are clearly supplanting it with something that is not of the scriptures. So with this advancing progression, we see this growing, frankly, hostility. So that when the Catholic Church comes back with the Roman Confutation, they understand the tone, which is why, by the time you get to the Council of Trent, they are correcting, or trying to correct the Lutheran's position, and saying, if you don't agree with what we're saying, let you be eternally condemned. In other words, they're pronouncing anathemas. And you know what that means, right? To say that if you don't agree with this teaching, whoever does not agree with this teaching, let it be anathematized, which is a fancy way of saying, go to hell. If you don't agree with this, go to hell. So you see this progression in the tone of the writings in history.
In that sense, they kind of picked up on the Athanasian Creed that has that element. Unless you believe this. Yeah.
Actually, older than that, Galatians.
Right.
Yeah, Paul says,
right.
Let it be anathema.
Yeah. If we or an angel of heaven preaches a different gospel, let him be anathema. Amen.
Galatians chapter 1,
for sure. Double check on the verses. So now we come to a scene that from June 25th, 1530, Melanchthon is not finished. Unfortunately, Melanchthon was compelled to continue modifying the document, that is the Augsburg Confession, just to be completely clear, after it had been adopted, signed, and publicly presented. These alterations became much more extensive in the Latin Octavo edition of 1531. We're still talking Augsburg Confession. And in the German revision of 1533. The Variata of 1540 and 1542, however, capped the climax as far as changes are concerned, some of them being very questionable also doctrinally. So now we have the origin of the altered Augsburg Confession. And when we refer to the unaltered Augsburg Confession, we mean this guy. And what Melanchthon introduces now are alterations. And there were some that became more popular than others. The ones that became more popular, like the Variata, became more popular because the other Protestants saw in Melanchthon's rewording, you know what, this can represent our faith too. You can be a good Calvinist and say what Melanchthon is saying. You see? So it opened the door for a false sense of unity with less clarity in the Lutheran position, the altered Augsburg Confession. So we confess in the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod, the unaltered Augsburg Confession. Now, we're not trying to beat up on Philip Melanchthon. The best construction, he was aiming for pedagogical teaching refinement, teaching clarity. He was a tremendous theologian, a great systematician. He wrote his own Loci, for example. You can read Melanchthon's Loci to this day, where he systematizes the entire faith. So he's searching for clarity. But sometimes you can try too hard, and you end up going too far. Sometimes we try too hard to give illustrations on the Holy Trinity. And before you know it, we're teaching heresy. Because we're trying too hard to teach the Trinity through illustration. And of course, we have to, you know, we admit up right off the bat, but there is no illustration that adequately represents the Holy Trinity. But there are some illustrations that are better than others. Yes, Melanie.
Is there any specifics that really require this alteration to happen after the alter version was created?
So I want you to be aware of some of those. So I'm going to share with you right now about some of those. So to talk about Melanchthon's alterations, while he had good intentions, there were terrible consequences. Rome, for example, as a result of Melanchthon's alterations, accused the Lutherans themselves as not knowing their own confession. Well, why are you redoing this? You know, don't you... You know, we need to see your consistency. So it opened the door for this sort of criticism. Most importantly, the Variata included an alternation to Article 10 of the Lord's Supper, which alternation permitted a Calvinistic understanding about the Supper. This opened the door to some Lutherans appropriately referred to as crypto-Calvinists, secretive, hiding Calvinists. But this is somewhat a misnomer, since it was the sincere followers of Melanchthon who were trying to work out the implications of his spiritualistic tendencies. Crypto-Philippists is a better terminology, really following Philip and the compromises he was writing about regarding the real presence, spiritualizing it, to the point where you were losing the thrust of real presence theology. In the end, the doctrinal development of this position would limit Christ's presence in the sacrament only in accord with his divine nature. The Variata was disowned by the Lutheran Church. Our vow is to the unaltered Augsburg Confession. In other words, our supper theology, our supper theology is parallel to our Christology. And so take into consideration, for example, that we teach the two natures of Christ. We teach his human nature and his divine nature. And we elaborate on the human and divine nature in terms of the three genera. We talk about the genus Idiomaticum, the genus Apotalismaticum, and the genus, I'm going to put Majestic here because I'm going to struggle with the Latin right now. And these terms are teaching us that to explain the two natures, the Idiomaticum refers to his Christ's basic attributes. So, for example, if you're talking about the fact that Jesus is omniscient as truly God, that attribute is communicated to the human nature so that the total person is omniscient. So whatever attribute you would describe to Jesus according to the divine, you would ascribe to the entire person because of something called the communication of attributes. The communication of attributes. And not only do we communicate the attributes in accord with the genus Idiomaticum to the human, but also the genus Apostolismaticum, which refers to his works. So, according to the divine nature, Jesus created the heavens and the earth. Well, we now attribute this to the whole person Jesus and say that Jesus is the creator of the heavens and the earth. As a matter of fact, he still creates. I think someone said that in one of our discussions a day or two ago, that he's still creating. He creates faith. Okay, Timothy said that. He creates faith. He is still the creator. And the Majestaticum refers to the worship. When we worship Jesus Christ, we do not just worship him according to his divine nature. We worship the person, the second person of the Holy Trinity, who is true God and true man. So what was start? Okay, so I got started here with this. Our supper theology parallels Christology. So, when we talk about what do we receive in the supper, the answer, we receive, and of course we say the body and blood, but we receive, another way of answering, we receive the whole Christ. We receive his body. We receive his blood. And this is the body and the blood of the God-man, the Theanthropos, the God-man Jesus. We receive him according to his two natures, what he is right now. And what Philip was doing was he was spiritualizing us and limiting the reception only of the divine nature, which is reminiscent of Calvinistic theology, which limits the presence of the human nature. So when Jesus ascended into heaven, he is in a specific locale in heaven, which according to the human nature represents a restriction, a limitation. There can only be a sharing of unity according to his divine presence. So this, at the end of the day, this is an extreme compromise from the Lutheran perspective. And Philip Melanchthon is going there, and this is why Molina's question is so important. Just how serious were these alterations? They were very serious. Please.
I never read the Variata, and I was just curious. Did Melanchthon just emphasize the spiritual reception, or did he actually exclude the bodily reception? Do you
That's
know?
A good question. The lengthened way is to give room for the other interpretation. Mm-hmm. He is not denying
That's
the original position,
right.
but he tries so hard to open doors
right.
for agreement
right.
that those doors are so wide open that it easily permits the other view.
Right.
So it's just aching for compromise. It's
sure.
inviting a watered-down version. Okay. Yes, please.
So the state church in Germany now is this kind of a mashup of Reformed and Lutheran. And of course, that's what the Saxons were getting out of in the Prussian Union.
That's right.
So would they be, I mean, would they use this sort of stuff as a way to create their unity between Reformed?
Positively, no question about it. Because there was such a powerful political impetus for unity, if you played ball in that cultural political climate as a church, you would enjoy certain advantages. And certainly we see this with the Prussian Union loud and clear by the time that comes. But there is this growing impression that at the end of the day, after all was said and done, and the Protestants broke away from the Roman Catholics, the Protestants really agree. And there is an objective, a real edifice to this day that stands in Berlin, in the Berlin Cathedral to this day. It is an incredibly beautiful cathedral in Berlin, Germany. Magnificent cathedral. But you walk in, and to the sides of the gorgeous altar, there are four very large white statues. And the four statues are of Luther, Calvin, Melanchthon, and Zwingli. And they're all getting along. So one of the statues of Zwingli, is looking towards the statue of Luther, who has his Bible open. And so I'm standing there, we're looking up at these statues. I'm with my son-in-law, Simon Folkmar. We're looking up, and I'm looking at the Luther statue and the Zwingli statue. And I'm like, wow, what? Well, do you see what's written in Luther's book? He's going, what? I said, he's looking at Zwingli saying, this is my body.
Is it fair to call that the depiction of all those statues liberal revisionism?
Absolutely. This is a historical revisionism that wants to claim at the end of the day we're all saying the same thing. Mm-hmm. After all, we're trying to put into words a mystery. What does it really matter? You know what? Beware of this argument. My stuff flows out of eschatology and apocalypticism. And I've lost track of how many people have said to me or have written or said on the radio or whatever, debates, it doesn't matter because we all believe Jesus is coming back at the end. So it doesn't matter what you believe. You want to talk about a dangerous argument? Because the implications of the other system lead to all kinds of other problems. Mm-hmm. It does matter. Mm-hmm. It does matter.
Can I ask one more
follow-up?
Does the Evangelist Church in Germany, do they officially confess the Variata? Or does anyone?
They officially confess the substance of the theology of the Variata.
Okay.
To the point that this was the reason why the independent Evangelical Lutheran Church in Germany was formed. Just clearly recognizing that the state German church has lost its Lutheran identity
mm-hmm.
in spite of its public label.
Mm-hmm.
So the independent Evangelical Lutheran Church in Germany has come back to say, no, we, like the LCMS, are staying with the original confession
mm-hmm.
without compromise.
Mm-hmm.
So it's understood that the state church has embraced this theology.
Mm-hmm. But do they proclaim it as their official? You know, it's like, this is 1542. They say not the original. we confess the, you know what I mean? Like we,
I've never seen
we're clear about
a
it.
Public document that says we officially embrace this Barriada or
mm-hmm.
this alternative publication.
Mm-hmm.
I've never seen that. I'm not aware of that.
Yeah.
But there's no doubt that the teaching
right.
is completely consistent.
Great.
With those.
Thank you.
So thank you, Baron, for getting us started on that note yesterday. Very, very important. Now, there was a Roman Catholic response that we call the Roman Confutation. All Romanists, the emperor included, were of the opinion that the Protestants must be brought back to the papal fold. Well, a number of the Catholic estates, incited by the theologians, were also in favor of immediately resulting to brutal forces. The emperor, for political reasons, considered it more advisable to employ kindness. The emperor just did not see the theological gulf between the two sides. But the Romanists did not share the mildness of the emperor. So I guess we could... You know, we can, you know, it's interesting to track history how God providentially works through civil leaders to bring some kind of advantage or help. I always think of King Cyrus of Persia, how he was involved in restoring the Israelites, right? In this case, you have an emperor who theologically was not on the side of the Lutherans, but held back the sword, held back the sword. So how did God work even through the emperor and at the end of the day helping to sustain the Lutheran movement?
Well, I mean, it's not just, I mean, it's the secular powers, if it weren't for them, the Reformation would have never got off the ground.
Exactly.
So, I mean, he's more of an example of maybe somebody who's ambivalent or perhaps even a little against the Reformation. But if it weren't for the princes that were for it,
right,
it wouldn't even got to that point.
Exactly. Yeah. So those princes were invaluable for providing the stage, providing the audience, and providing a peaceable enough environment for the perpetuation.
Yeah, another side note for the background is the so-called signers of the autos, different names of autos.
Yes. Yes. Like the electors, for example. Yeah.
So. Sorry, go ahead, Mike.
Well, I was just going to, for comment further, I mean, not just the German electors, but, I mean, you think about it, the whole thing started off because Charles V, the civil ruler, called for it, like Constantine, who called for the Council of Nicaea. So these civil leaders all throughout church history are really the kind of movers.
And what you're saying now was the reason I brought up the comparison to Cyrus,
mm-hmm.
because this emperor not only gives basically the Lutherans a stage before the empire by virtue of being before the emperor, but when the Romans want to resort to a brutish response, he effectively preserves them. Of course, it would have been quite a battle with all the electors lined up, but effectively is being used by God to, at the end of the day, put the Lutherans in a better position to proceed. Fascinating.
Now, we're talking about more of a religious battle, but do you think it was more of a financial battle for the church, you know, the people who represent all the bearers and all that interest?
Yeah. Yeah, so Daniel's asking an extremely important question. Did everybody hear the question? So there has been more ink spilled on your question than I can even begin to describe. What exactly was the cause for the Reformation? Was it cultural? Was it political? Was it theological? Was it, you know? And you can see all these aspects involved in answering the question. Yes, yes, and yes. However, our view is to appreciate that at the end of the day, you had a theological focus. There was a theological argument. There was a theological division. And whether you're talking about the ecclesiastical power or the political power, they kept referring back to that. There is this division precisely because of the theology. And what drove, furthermore, what drove those political forces? We've been talking about the electors who stood up for the Lutherans. What drove them to have the boldness to get on their knees and offer their necks, essentially, to the emperor? It was their theological conviction. It was their faith. So from our view, what we recommend unhesitatingly is that this is a theological issue. This is a faith issue. This is a biblical issue. And it's one that certainly involved all these other aspects you mentioned, because observe how the Roman Catholic Church became so politically powerful. And so, yes, it's going to involve the political stream and the other streams, but at the core, it's a theological question. And even the Pope's identity is a theological issue. It's been debated now for 1,000 years. So we recommend that theological impetus.
So this is just kind of a thought, and you can tell me if I'm way off here. It seems like, you know, when you're talking about church and state and in the Reformation, it was like the power that needed to be held in check wasn't really the state, it was the church. They were the ones that were running wild. Whereas we often talk about the power that needs to be in, you know, 2016 in America is not the church, but the state. The state is the one that's, you know, going beyond its mandate kind of thing. Is that accurate?
I think what you brought up and the way you brought it up is fascinating. I think we're in a good position with our system, our systematics, to have a very fruitful discussion about this very thing, because even while we confess the two-kingdom theory that Luther advocated, and that is beautifully outlined in the book Christ and Culture, we know that at the end of the day, theologically, everyone is religious. Everyone has some kind of ultimate worldview religion that drives them. And this is energized, and this is legitimized by theological convictions and assertions. Have you ever noticed how busy some atheists can be in writing books about why God does not exist?
Right. Very evangelistic in their atheism.
Very evangelistic. They have religious fervor. And they are theologically minded because they're always talking about God. Right. So everyone at the end of the day is religious. Everyone has a theological position. I've never met a person who did not have a theological position. They believe something about God. They may say God doesn't exist. Well, you believe something about God then. And by the way, I'd rather talk to an honest atheist any day of the week over an agnostic who tries to skirt every question. So I mention that to you because, yes, while formally we do see the two kingdoms, at the end of the day, there's this. It's Paul in Ephesians 5. Our battle is not against flesh and blood, right? The spiritual battle permeates our entire world. So when I back up and I think of that, I think about how the Roman Catholic Church had a phenomenal influence on the political scene. Think of all the times in history that Roman emperors would not go to war unless they were blessed by the Pope. That's how powerful the Pope was. Now, I think it's easy to shift gears. I think the way you shifted gears is perfectly understandable. And I think most people would agree with you in terms of now considering culture in America. Well, now it's different. I'm not so sure. I think our current president has some very strong religious convictions. You know, and I'm not going to sit here and get into examining all his convictions, but
he is driven by some religious convictions that affect his being a political leader. And when I've studied evangelicalism in America, they have a tremendous preoccupation with influencing the political system because not only do they not have this two-kingdom distinction that we do, but if you take away the sacraments as your way of connecting to God in a real way, everyone yearns and thirsts for a connection to God. There has to be a way where I see my spirituality manifest. Certainly one way I'm going to see it manifest is through my sanctification, but another way I'll see it manifest is through how I impact the world. And if I can impact the world by bringing Christianity into the state, and I start to convert the world, well, now my Christianity really is at work. So, Niebuhr, as you guys, I'm sure you're familiar with, you know, he talks about these five systems of the relationship between church and Christ and culture. And you have an extreme position here, which is Christ of culture. And then another extreme position here, which is Christ against culture. And here you have the philosophy that the way the world and the faith get along or are balanced is that you just delve into the culture here. You just delve into the world. The problem with this approach is that you become indistinguishable from the world. You become a chameleon. You can't even recognize the salt and light of a Christian anymore because they're too much in the world. Your faith doesn't even make an impact anymore. Over here, you're so against culture that you start to leave the world. Like, you become like a monk. You just leave society altogether. It's kind of an Amish approach, sort of. But after a while, you're asking, well, if we're to be salt and light, how do we... We're not even connected to the world anymore. But in between, you have these other views. Or you have these other views. And... over here you have Christ above culture, and you have Christ transforming, Christ above culture here, Christ above culture here, and Christ transforming culture here. Where here, you're going to, I just realized I wrote down the same thing. I'm sorry. Pardon me. Okay, so you come closer to the center from Christ of culture, where it's indistinguishable, to Christ transforming. And what we're doing here with Christ transforming, we're saying, wait a minute. We're going to go into the society, we're going to go into the institutions, and we're going to try to convert them from within. So we're going to make the cultural and political entities more mindful of faith and try to convert them from within. This one will say, you're probably thinking too ideally. And what we really have to do is we have to set up separate institutions. So where you have secular schools, you need religious schools. So you're going to set up Christian communities as alternatives from the secular options. And the one that we commend to you that we think Niebuhr is right in his study, and that is Christ and culture in paradox. And it maintains Luther's two-kingdom theory. It says, you know, the kingdom of the left, indeed, is a political kingdom of power. The kingdom of the right is, indeed, an ecclesiastical, spiritual, grace-oriented power. And they're always to be distinguished. But God sends his people into the world. And we are in the world, but not of the world, but God will use you through light, not to try to change institutions, necessarily, but to witness to one individual at a time. And along the way, as you share the faith with individuals and they come to believe in Christ, they will go on to do the same thing. It just multiplies. And I think that in America, you have a very strong tendency from neo-evangelicalism, though I know it's a very broad term, to go here to set up Christian institutions with a goal to so influence society that you can reclaim America as a Christian nation. Tim LaHaye, of course, the great eschatological writer of neo-evangelicalism, is a big fan of how we can bring Christian candidates forward so as to, again, reclaim our identity as a Christian nation. That was a very long way of saying, responding to Timothy's question, well, yes, we always need to keep the two kingdoms before us. What I see in practice is this: people are very religious, the way I started to answer the question. And you see that religiosity being expressed in how can I transform the world? How do I change it? It's happening all the time. Neo-evangelicalism is very active that way to this day. Ironically, it kind of mirrors what was happening in the Reformation. Certainly it was more structured and more deliberate, I guess one might say, but you still had that basic effort. The Roman Confutation, the insinuation of the Roman Confutation lurking in the document everywhere, was that the confession of the Lutheran princes was in glaring contradiction to the real doctrine of their pastors. The sinister scheme of the Romanists, as the elector in 1536 reminded the Lutheran theologians, was to bring the princes in opposition to their preachers. How about that? The Confutation proposed just days after the Augsburg Confession was presented. It was compiled by Eck and Faber from various Roman contributors, ready by July 8th, and presented to the emperor on the 12th or 13th. The emperor returned the bulky document on the 15th, requesting refinement. The much refined document that would come to be known as the Confutation was submitted on July 30th. And read in the presence of the emperor on August 3rd. It was, get this, it was not published until 1573, after the Council of Trent had officially adopted many of its positions.
Talking about sneaky.
Yeah, very sneaky. Very sneaky. Finally, on September 22nd, the emperor officially declared the Diet recessed, stating that the papal Confutation had refuted the confession of the Lutheran princes, and that therefore the Lutherans had until April 15th, 1531, to accept his terms. By that time, he also would decide what had to be done. The Lutherans never received a copy, but many had heard it and took copious notes. They knew the general content. The princes authorized a response. Melanchthon worked all winter to produce the apology. In the spring of 1531, after the deadline, the Lutheran answer was the publication of the Augsburg Confession and the apology of the Augsburg Confession. So, let me ask Wesley anything you'd like to share about the history.
You covered a lot of the background that I looked up. Things that I noted were the Confutation and how the Charles kind of commissioned the Confutation to be written once the confession was originally given. But then again, the response from the they call it the evangelical side. There were various backers of the confession that kind of commissioned the apology that were dukes, princes, mayors, various political offices, rather than wasn't directly from the pastors. It was commissioned by the political realm. And they kind of got the ball rolling on that with Luther and Melanchthon to get the response together.
Yeah.
And I noticed in the reading that the Apology contains a lot of the same sections as the Confession, but not all of them.
Yeah.
And as I expect, it's because they did agree on some points.
Yes.
Didn't want to waste extra pages doing that. So.
Well said. Very good contribution, and I love the fact that you brought out something that I think I've neglected up to this point. They like to be called evangelicals.
Which today has such a different connotation.
Absolutely, but this is an extremely important point, and see, God blesses us through all of our minds together. When Luther first heard the designation Lutheran, he was extremely offended. And said to the effect, why would God's people be named after a bag of maggots like myself? He didn't want that name. Now, later he would concede and say, now, if Lutheran means Christian, then so be it. But having said that, there was a preference to the identity. Certainly, the people wanted to be associated with Luther's faithful Confession, but the name that really rang true to the identity was evangelical. We are of the gospel. That's what we are as a church. We are of the gospel. And you're right. We've lost that identity, and now there's a different meaning to evangelical in America today.
And even the church body that has that connected with Lutheran isn't really that either evangelical or
yep.
Lutheran.
You're right. Time for our 10-minute break. Sorry, I went over a couple minutes. 10 minutes. Thanks, Wesley. That was really good.
Thank you.
What was the class we had last year? Oh, I wasn't even in your class, was I?
No, we had the World Religions class.
Weren't you? You were in...
the World Religions class.
Oh, you're right.
No.
You're right. You weren't in my class.
Right.
Yeah, you were in the class
just,
with Clarence.
Yeah, we were just roommates.
Yeah, right, yeah. We were in the class together, though, the year before. The one with
Seltz.
Seltz. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You said David Kim?
Yes.
And what is he doing? Okay.
So he's also going to speak at the summit, right? He had a session at the summit for Friday. So he allowed us to.
So this is your last one?
Day,
and then you got to do your thesis?
Thesis, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Evening.
Okay.
So you checked that book out. I was going to get that book from my book report, but you got it. I saw it was checked out.
When did you check?
Yesterday.
Oh, that's right when I got it. I barely got through ahead of you.
Yeah. It's okay. I got a couple others, actually. I got one. I already was only 105 pages. So
oh, okay. Yeah, this one hits the...
Yeah,
Sometimes when I look at both books.
Yeah, sorry about that.
No, it's okay. I'm just teasing you. No, no, there's plenty of other books. I didn't have to have that one at all.
What's Clarence taken?
Clarence has taken Luke and... I think it's Luke and Acts.
Oh, cool.
It's going on right now.
With Nindorf?
No. Clinton Armstrong.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, when you... Exactly.
I had him that first year.
With the background.
We had that class
with
Sells.
Yeah.
He was clearly...
He's an art professor.
That's good.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And they're all, in fact, we were talking after class yesterday, and they came in and they were kind of like crying, oh, we have to get through this class.
At least he only has one, then not two classes, right?
Yeah, yeah, they scheduled this.
Hey, Jim.
Hey, brother. How you doing,
Jim?
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, is he staying?
This being my last class, there was a couple of profs I was hoping I would have, and I never did. Adam Francisco, I wish I had him. He was one of them, so I'm getting him. And I never had.
Would he teach anything in this program?
Adam Francisco? I don't know.
I think most of the stuff he teaches is on Islam.
I think he's on the faculty here.
Well, he is on the faculty, but I don't think that he would teach any courses that you would want to have.
Oh, yeah, maybe not. I mean, world religions, possibly, but...
I suppose, yeah. Although Islam is his area of expertise.
Right.
I don't know.
So you never had him either?
No, and I don't expect to either.
So is he just undergrad?
I guess probably what he teaches most of his classes, though, yeah.
I still wish I could have had him.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he does a lot of seminars. You could probably get in on one of his seminars.
Yeah.
He does seminars all around the country.
Okay. Yeah, I got to track him down. And then, I mean, you can listen these days. You can find a podcast or a YouTube presentation, which is cool. Yeah. You know, lifelong learning.
Yeah, right. That's how you be a good teacher, is always learn.
Yeah. Right. And it's different because when you pursue that avenue, it's you just take your time. There's no tests, you know. And some ways you have more time to assimilate. You go at your own pace, but you don't push yourself as hard as in a class, structured class, you know.
That's the one advantage of you know, having these deadlines is you actually do get it done because you got to.
Right. Plus the benefit of live class or interactive with the professor and the other students, you know, so you got that benefit. I mean, as far as that goes, I suppose when you're, if you got some friends you're learning with, you know, you can debate with, or if you teach a class, you know, your students will ask questions and you get that give and take. Or do you have to talk on?
So Article 18. Free will.
Did you want this book too?
No. I check his list, right? Then I just try to find whatever I had already in book, so I have to pick one of those. So. Otherwise, you'll start looking for the book, right? Which one I'm going to choose? Then you won't say, well, which one that's available?
Right. So Article 18, which is what? What's Article 18?
Free will.
Oh, that's a good one.
Yeah.
Oh, my.
Are you doing one?
I'm not assigned yet.
Until tomorrow, probably.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You got to join us for coffee in the morning. We're out of coffee again, like last year. Right?
If I can get myself up.
Oh, is that right? Sleeping in, huh?
Yeah, well, today I did. Yesterday I didn't, but I didn't know where you guys were yet.
Oh, yeah. Which one are you in? I forgot where you said you're at.
I'm in 127.
Oh, you're on the bottom.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You're probably like right above me.
Yeah, we're in 223.
Okay. Yeah, I have to come over and say hi to Clarence. But she's
not getting anything out of her. 228.
Based on our surgeon's view, I said that there's a radiological oncologist on her own team. She says, I'd seek a second.
You're you who?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it was probably a mistake.
Really?
Yeah, just because.
I think Galatians 5.
It was a drive-through rush hour.
Fruits of the Spirit.
There's seven of them. I've got seven of them to enter here. The last two are going to be
Well, the Lord continues to provide.
Amen.